kavu ha-beit din, any rule of evidence which is not established by a court, lo mikla edut, is not considered as valid evidence, zulat beiz shnei edim shamrata rabba peirush. In other words, the alpi shnei edim yakum davar, or shlosha edim yakum davar, is a fallback position. In absence of any legislation of Chazal as to what constitutes evidence, then you need two witnesses. But should Chazal legislate that one witness is enough, then this is in Simon Chafez and Ibn Ezra. Okay, let's read further. אבל כשישבו ביתים והסכימו על מופת מן המופתים, כשישבו ביתים והסכימו על מופת מן המופתים שהוא יהיה חשוב כעדים, if Chazal have decided that some piece of evidence is as valuable as two witnesses, הרי זה רצוי לפני המקום על פי התורה. וכן כתבו תוספות בנזיר שיש כוח ביד חכמים לקבוע מהו בית מצווה. That when Chazal said that a Kohen can be metameh for his arusa, they've essentially declared her to be his betrothed bride to be a mate mitzvah, even if she dies, even if she has a father or a brother or so on. כמו שנראה להם העניין שקרובים יתפשלו מקבורתו. וכן כתבו תוספות עבוד הזרה שיש כוח ביד חכמים לקבוע הדברים בעניין צער בעלי חיים.
If you remember when we were learning Avodah Zarah, the Tosfot said that the Chazanish is interpreting the decision of Tosfot to say that the notion of Tzar Balei Chayim is simply a general principle that you have to be concerned for pain and suffering of animals. But if this comes into conflict with human needs, if you have to run a food research lab or what have you, then the issue of deciding what constitutes an overriding human need to allow Tzar Balei Chayim and what not, this is given to Chazal to decide, and their decision then becomes a din d'oraita. In other words, what I'm saying here is that this is a tendency we see both in the Chazal nation and in the Tziv to empower the Chazal with the final crystallization and formulation of what constitutes a din d'oraita and what constitutes a din d'oraita. My view on this is essentially directly the opposite. That is, I think that what we're dealing here with is not that there's a notion of... Let me raise the following question, because I think that it bears on this as well. I mean, the general thrust of what I'm saying is that Chazal didn't invent the halach. That is, it's not that in the period from the Churban HaBayit until 4 or 5 centuries later, the laws became crystallized, but somehow or other they didn't exist prior. In fact, what I'm saying is that there were laws, that these laws were formulated and reformulated and changed and relaxed, but that even the whole note, but certain things which were on a par with what we now call a din d'oraita became, on occasion, demoted to a din d'rabbana. I have no doubt in my mind that the prohibition against riding on a horse on Shabbat, for which a person we have evidence was executed for, was up on the same par of writing a letter on Shabbat and so on, during the period towards the close of Bayit Sheni, but that after the formulation of the Lamed Tet Melachot, where it never fit into this, so to speak, reformulation or abstract formulation of Hilchot Shabbat, the law was reinterpreted as a din d'rabbanan and then as a gzera, and that gzera is now based on something that we would find far-fetched. And in fact, the Rishonim are aware of this. The Ramban on Chumash tells us many times that the notion of a shvut on Shabbat falls under the general category of mitzvah taseh because of the fact that there just has to be a general difference between Shabbat and Shabbat. But let me ask you an even further question here, because I think it's relevant to us. On the Gemara, practically every page, we find the question of whether something is d'oraita or d'rabbanan. How many times do we find this question raised in the Mishnah? Where do we see in the Mishnah that there is a discussion as to whether a particular law is a d'oraita or d'rabbanan? Let's make a statistical survey of all of the Mishnayot, and let's ask ourselves this very question. Namely, what I'm trying to suggest is even the notion that there's a difference between a d'oraita and a d'rabbanan is not so apparent in the earlier halakha. And for this purpose, I'm asking, where do we find this question raised at all in Mishnah? In the Gemara, we find it practically every other page. Is this a din d'oraita? Is this a gzeira? Is this a gzeira?
I got a complete serpent.
That's not a question as to whether a particular law is construed as a d'oraita or d'rabbanan. That's just declaring that a certain historical fact. So I wouldn't include that. I made a list, maybe I missed some, but I came up with essentially 4.5 times. I will list 6 or 7 times, but we will see the 2 or 3 of them really aren't what I have in mind. Okay, so there's sufficiently few that I can even just go through all of them, so in case I've missed some, you'll call them to my attention when you review all of your Mishnayot and we can run through all of the Shishas Grei Mishnah. Okay? The first place that I find it is the most famous place, of course, and that's at the end of Masechet Orlah. It says, Safek Allah be'eretz Yisrael asur u'besur yemutar. So this is the last Mishnah in Masechet Orlah. Safek Allah be'eretz Yisrael asur u'besur yemutar u'b'chutz la'aretz yored v'lokeach u'ruvat shelo yoren u'lokeach. Kerem shum natura yerek v'yerek. And then the famous phrase, "Hachadash asur min haTorah b'chol makom, v'ha'olah halacha v'aklayim midivrei sofer." So that's famous quotation that the Chacham Sofer used to like to use in his fight against the Reform movement, "Achadash asur min haTorah b'chol makom." Okay, so there the Torah is making that's what he used. In Masechet Sota we find Bo biyom de perk hey halacha beis mishnah beis. Bo biyom de rash Rabbi Akiva v'chol kli cheres asher yipol mehem al tocho kol asher b'tocho yitama eino omer tamei ela yitama letamei et ha'achelin lomeid al hakikar ha'sheni sheyitamei et ha'shlishi. A technical thrust, a technical law in the Kol Tuma that something sheni can make a shlishi. Amar Rabbi Yehoshua mi yegale afar me'anecha. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai Shaita Omer, Atid Dor Achron Metaheret Kikar Hasheni, She'ein Lo Min HaTorah. But Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai declared that this custom of considering the third contact, Tumah touches one loaf, which touches a second loaf, which touches a third, that this has no basis Min HaTorah. V'harei Akiva Talmidcha Evi Lo Mikra Min HaTorah Shu Tamei She'nemar V'Kol Asher V'Kol Kol Yitma. In other words, there's a discussion as to whether the Kikar HaShlishi has a status of Tumah. Alright? Here's an example which I don't include, but the word Min HaTorah is used, so let's just see what it's in contestation to. In HaSocher HaPoalim, in Bava Metzia, Perek Shvi'i Mishnah Beis, Eilu Ochlim Min HaTorah. The following workers can eat food in the field within Torah. Ha'osedu Chubar LaKalka B'Shat Gemar Melacha, U'Vitalush Min HaKalka Ad Shalod Migmar Melachto, U'Vidavar Shegidu Layot Min HaAretz. Ve'eilu She'ein Ochlim, Ha'osedu Chubar LaKalka B'Shat She'ein Gemar Melacha, U'Vitalush Min HaKalka Miachar Shegmar Melachto, U'Vidavar She'ein Yudol Min HaKalka. Okay? So the Gemara is
distinguishing between Ochlim Min HaTorah and not Ochlim Min HaTorah, but that distinction is not between Min HaTorah and the Rabbanan, but rather, as we see in Mishnah Chet in the same parak, Shomrei Parot Holchim Mihilchot HaMedina Aval Lo Min HaTorah. That certain classes of workers, the guards, can eat because of custom rather than from law. So the distinction here between the contrast is not between Min HaTorah or Min HaRabbanan, but between Min HaTorah or Min Hilchot Medina. That is between law and custom rather than between. Okay. Here's another very famous Mishnah that we studied several times, especially because of Be'er Sharamam. This is Masechet Menachot. Okay. Mishakara HaOmer, on the 16th day of Nisan, once the Omer, Kavana Omer, was brought, Hutar HaChadash Miyad. Then the Chadash was immediately permissible. Okay. Chokim, those people who lived far away from Yerushalayim, so, and therefore could not know when exactly the Kavan HaOmer was brought, Mutarim Echatzot Hayom Ulahala. They were allowed to eat after 12 noon because they could presume that there would not be a delay in the Omer past 12 o'clock. May I remind you that the Rambam here on 12 noon points out that it's 12 noon Jerusalem time, not 12 noon local time. לפיכך אני אומר שצריכים לשמוע על חצות היום ירושלים לא חצות היום אצל אנשי אותו המקום לפי שאפשר שיהיה לפני כן או אחרי כן וידוע הדבר זה בידיעת אורך הארצות. You have to know your longitude. Oh, of course, Aratzot is the longitude. If you know your longitude, then you can figure out what the difference is in hours between you and Jerusalem. And therefore, for example, in Boston, you'd be able to eat at 6 o'clock in the morning because it will already been 12 noon in Jerusalem.
That's a proximity, no?
Yeah. Okay, Umishacharav, I just bring, that has nothing to do with the shiur, but I'm reminding you of it because we studied this several times. Umishacharav Beit HaMikdash, after the destruction of the temple, Etkin Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai Shiyehe Yom HaNov Kulo Asur. That the entire 16th day will be prohibited. That was, the Mishnah says that this was one of the takanot of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Amar Rabbi Yehuda v'halo min HaTorah hu Asur, Shenemar Etzam HaYom HaZeh. Okay, so that there you find the dispute from the Tanaim as to whether the Isur of Yom HaNov is Asur Midyaraita or Midrabanan. And then, of course, there's the famous Mishnah in Cholin, in Perek Kalabasa, the 8th Perek, Mishnah Dalit. בשר בהמה טהורה וחלב בהמה טהורה אסור לבשל ויאסור בהניה, בשר בהמה טהורה וחלב בהמה טמאה, ובשר בהמה טמאה וחלב טהורה ובהמה טמאה, מותר לבשל ומותר בהניה. רבי עקיבא אומר, חיה ועוף אינן מן התורה. שנאמר, לא תבשל גדי בחלב אמו, לא תבשל גדי בחלב אמו, לא תבשל שלושה פעמים, כלת לחיה ולעוף ולבהמה טמאה. So that's a clear-cut case where there's a distinction, discussion amongst the Tanaim as to whether having chicken with... there's another Mishnah in Mikvaot, which I will skip, just because we're running out of time. And then there's a Mishnah, but at any rate, it's in Perek Shishimi, in Sachet Mikvaot. On the question, alright, Eruv Mikvah HaMikvaot, Kishraver HaTanol, the Kaviyah Chachalala, Kishtei Etzvot Chazot Umkamon, Safek Shuhu Kishraver HaTanol, Safek Sheinah Kishraver HaTanol, Psulam, Mepnei Shehim in HaTorah. So the Mishnah is making a distinction between the requirements there, etc. Okay. And then in Masechet Parah, Kol HaTaun Biyat Mayim Midivrei Torah, Matameyat HaKodesh Biyat HaTorah Biyat HaChulin Biyat HaMaaser, Biyasur Al Biyat Mikdash, Biyachar Biyato, Matameyat HaMikdash HaKosel Tumah, etc. etc. So it's distinguishing between two levels of Tumah, whether you're Tamei Min HaTorah or only Tamei Min HaRabbanan. And then finally, another very famous Mishnah in Masechet Yadayim, Parak Gimel Mimisachat Yadayim Kol HaPosel At HaTchumah Matamei At Yadayim Liyot Shniyot V'Hayad Matamei At Chavratah Divrei Rabbi Yehoshua V'Chachamim Omrim Ein Sheni Yoseh Sheni Amar Lahem V'Lo Kitfei HaKodesh Shniyim Matamim At HaYadayim Amru Lo Ein Danim Divrei Torah Midivrei Sofrim V'Lo Divrei Sofrim Midivrei Torah V'Lo Divrei Sofrim Midivrei Sofrim. I think I've exhausted all of the places in the Mishnah where this distinction between a Din Torah, the Din Yoraita, and a Din Rabbanan is made. And the thrust of my point is, and I don't think there's been really an adequate study of this, as to when this notion of the distinction between a Din Yoraita and a Din Rabbanan came into play. I would suspect that it also came, the whole notion of this distinction between the Deoraita and the Rabbanan and is relative just shortly before or during the time of the Mishnah. And the notion that you're going to divide the laws into more important ones and less important ones was something that was relatively late, and in Hilchot Shabbat maybe even later. In other words, my view of the subject is that there were many, many prohibitions in Hilchot Shabbat, and there was a gradual relaxation of all of the laws of Shabbat, an eventual reformulation of the laws of Shabbat to be construed as creative industrial acts, and that the notion of that an Isur Melacha or an Av Melacha is the only thing that's really prohibited in Shabbat made many of the other laws difficult to understand. What I'm saying is that the laws of Muktzah, in my view, were an integral part of Shabbat in the same sense that they are today. I mean, if you ask an uneducated person, what is Shabbat all about? It's Muktzah. Don't touch. Right? Reformulate Muktzah as don't carry. And that's the halachic, final halachic formulation. You find one or two strands, that's why I have the Rishonim, but I'll wait until next week to cite it precisely. If you like, we can do it tonight. That there may have been even this common notion that Muktzah is associated with not touching may have really existed at one time, but certainly the notion of an object being prohibited to touch or to use and to so on was something which was so common to the mind of the people, so long as you had Hilchot Tumah, that the idea that this was part and parcel of Hilchot Shabbat, just as not going Chutz L'Chum was part and parcel of Hilchot Shabbat, just as not riding on a horse was part and parcel of Shabbat, none of these makes sense once the laws of Shabbat have been reformulated to be only creative industrial acts as Avot Melacha. We find many, many of the places in the Gemara where they're trying to explain previous Isurim in Shabbat and divide them up into they're now not considered as the Araita but only the Rabbanan and so on. And then after this process has gone through, something like the Mishnah, which is prohibited the eating of an egg on Shabbat and Yom Tov, becomes extraordinarily difficult to understand. It becomes difficult to understand because we're viewing these halachot through the perspective of how we understand Hilchot Shabbat today, and I suspect that this Mishnah is a remnant of the earlier halacha when Muktzah had a much more serious grip on the mentality.
He's saying that the framework of Olam HaTet Melachot was the source of the prohibitions, or the other way around.
I'm saying that there were, let me say what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that there were many, many Hilchot Shabbat, which were generally accepted as being prohibited.
Okay.
These laws were gradually relaxed over a period of time, and then there was some final intellectual reformulation and abstract formulation of these laws as abstract formulation of all of the laws. I mean, there was a period of time in which, in a sense, a codex was being formulated to formalize and explain laws that everybody understood to exist. And that this formulation of the laws of Shabbat as Avot Melacha was one part of the crystallization process, formulation process, but also part of the relaxation process of the laws themselves.
And that when we try to look at some of the earlier halachot through the prism of the way we view Hilchot Shabbat today, and the Gemara tries to do it, we find some of these things, like Hilchot Muktzah, extremely hard for us to understand. Yes?
And your principle for rotation, you don't have that in Muktzah?
No. I'm saying, for example, that riding on a horse on Shabbat was probably a very serious prohibition, a capital offense at one time. Right. And now it's only Gzeirah d'Rabbanan.
Yeah, but in this case, they paid levels when the laws were not related to the rest of us.
Sure. There are many examples. Oh, sure. I'm not saying that all laws were relaxed, and I'm not even saying that all Hilchot Shabbat were relaxed. But I'm simply saying that the main thrust of what has happened to Hilchot Shabbat was that there was a relaxation of the laws and a reformulation of the law. And that therefore...
But the Tekanot Ezra is not relaxation, it's stripping the laws of Shabbat.
First of all, you're talking, I don't know what... which Takanot of Ezra you're talking about, and I'm talking about, I have no idea of what was happening before the time of Ezra. I make no attempt to go that far back. It's quite conceivable to me that the laws of Shabbat and Bayit Rishon, the way they were practiced, were much less severe than they were in the time of the middle of Bayit Sheni. But I'm saying, and Gemara, for example, tries to attribute the strictness in the laws of Shabbat to the time of Ezra or to the time of Nehemiah. I mean, I don't know what 100 years, where Nehemiah sits vis-a-vis Ezra, but assuming that they lived within 100 years of one another, who came first, I don't know. But whatever there was that period of time at the beginning of Bayit Sheni that I have no idea of what the actual current
reference point is.
But my reference point is sometime, say, 200 years prior to the Churban Bayit Sheni, where we begin to have more detailed historical evidence as far as the way people actually lived as far as Hilchot Shabbat. Remember, in Bayit Rishon, Shabbat and Rosh Chodesh were things which were more or less on a par with one another. Okay, what I'm saying, okay, so, and certainly there were many takanot which were instituted later. I'm not denying the existence of takanot. I'm simply saying that this repeated questioning as to whether something is d'oraita or d'rabbanan, and this dichotomy of division of things into d'oraita and d'rabbanan, frequently simply reflects a revision of the views of the severity of something. Let me give you a simple example. We saw that the laws of Kalim were relaxed. I would guess that what was dealing there with was that there were lots of technological innovations and that people had new forms of Kalim that they didn't know how to deal with, and these things became prohibited, much like the process that we're going through today vis-a-vis, say, electrical appliances. Everybody assumes that the usage of electrical appliances has some clearly thought out halachic basis, which was discussed by some group of rabbanim who sat down to think it all through and discuss it with one another and came out with a series of prohibitions. But that's certainly not what happened. We saw when we were studying these laws that there was a very important and interesting tshuva from the Lemberger Rav, from the Beis Yitzchak, from Yitzchak Shmelkes, who said that you're not allowed to use electrical appliances. I'm not talking about lights, but things like telephone and motors and things of this nature. He prohibited them, but he prohibited them from an obscure Gemara in Beitza. If we ever get that far in Beitza, we will review those laws. And in the same breath, and for the same reason, he prohibited making soda water. You know, putting chemical reaction.
Moly.
Because of moly. Now, nobody accepts this prohibition against making soda water on Shabbat. Everybody screws the pellet into the salsa bottle, right? And practically everybody accepts the prohibition against the use of electrical appliances on Shabbat. And then, of course, there was then a later reformulation or explanation of the reasons for the prohibition. Chazon Ish came up with this strange idea that has to do with binyan. Nobody thought of that before. It obviously was an explanation for a currently existing prohibition rather than thinking through ab initio whether something should be prohibited or not, there's no question in my mind that in the course of the next 50 or 100 years, when the usage of electrical appliances will become so essential, and we see the signs of it in going up in a Shabbat elevator or riding on the escalator or what have you, that these laws, which are thoroughly entrenched in our consciousness as being prohibited on Shabbat, I really believe that 100 years from now, most of them will disappear. That is, someone will come back and think through, and we see that when Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, as we saw, has begun to attack all of these things. He's perhaps too timid to say halacha lemaisa, so he says shalom lemaisa, but we understand full well that he's coming out against it, and it's going to be the change in the way we live more than anything else which will come to the understanding that you have to have more utensils at your disposal in Shabbat than a fork and a knife and a ladle for the soup. You just can't live a normal daily existence without moving your hanger and hanging up your jacket or moving the chair around and things like that. We become technologically so dependent upon these items that they becomes an inordinate burden to maintain these laws. Okay? And so what I'm saying is that we're going through such a historical process now, and I suspect that 100 years from now, when we look back, we'll say, gee, they were very strict about the usage of electrical appliances on Shabbat way back in the 20th century. And something similar, but on a much broader scale, was happening to Hilchot Shabbat and Hilchot Yom Tov during the transition from the middle of Bayit Sheni till the time of the Mishnah. During that period of 400 years, all of the evidence points to the fact that the laws of Shabbat were very, very strict and were not formulated in terms of avot melacha or creative industrial production, and eventually they were reformulated in that way. And if we understand that, then we can at least understand that if we have some of the laws, especially as far as the laws of Muktzah, that come down to us, and they're strange to us because they reflect an honest early tradition, but one which, because of the way we view the halakha today, and I say we, I'm including the time of the Gemara, views the halakha today, these things become difficult. And that's my answer to the question as to why the Gemara finds this Mishnah so hard to understand. Next, we will go into more detail into the laws of Muktzah themselves and see how the Gemara actually formulates these laws.
Isn't the Torah strong enough to answer these questions? Had Nachmash Sinai?